Very much, Martin. Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We've got, in theory, four speakers, but in practice, three, who are going to make introductory remarks for 5 minutes each, and then we'll have a dialogue between the speakers and the floor. The first is Sue Lloyd Roberts, who may be known to you as a BBC, distinguished BBC correspondent, based currently in their World Affairs unit, and she's broadcast from Zimbabwe undercover, I think, on several occasions, the last being in September. Sue, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Well, I see my role here as a journalist. I'm not a diplomat or a politician, but perhaps as a broadcast journalist I can bring to you some of the voices from Zimbabwe, having been there quite recently. Going to Harare a few months ago was a shocking experience. The first thing that strikes you is everybody is waiting. You see queues everywhere. They form before dawn in Harare, people queuing for bread, mealy meal, oil, petrol. Private motorists have almost given up on finding petrol. You only find the commercial vehicles, and ironically, the buses waiting to take locals out of the country, they even have to wait days for petrol. Nonetheless, an estimated near 3.5 million out of a population of 13 million in Zimbabwe have now left the country. Reports last week talk of people literally dropping down dead in the streets from hunger. In a voice in received by Southwest Africa Radio, we heard of a man queuing at a cash point in order to get money out to go to a clinic for medical help, and he dropped down dead while waiting for money, which even money is now in short control, in short supply. I'd like to quote from one queuer that I interviewed in while I was there in Harare a few months ago, who said, "I've been there before dawn. There's no mealy meal, no cooking oil, even bread. We have to queue for bread maybe for 5 hours, and you queue and you don't get anything. Most of the time we're disadvantaged by policemen in uniform and soldiers. If they get to hear that there is something, let's say there's mealy meal, they come there and they pretend to be organizing the queues. Then they start buying things before us. So most of the time it's the police and soldiers who loot everything in the shops." Go to the hospitals and the picture there is equally bleak. Because of petrol, only the lucky ones get there. In one Bulawayo hospital I went to a few months ago, women had walked miles to get there, pregnant women had walked miles to get there, simply in order to be in a place of safety when they finally deliver, to be in a place where they can guarantee food and water and care. Mothers stumble in with malnourished children. In 30 years of reporting on the developing world, I've never seen such appalling signs of malnourishment. 18 months ago, in the same hospital, on a previous trip to Zimbabwe, I remember one of the most devastating scenes, if you like, in the film that I made, of a woman arriving at 7 o'clock at night, having walked 4 miles with her 6-year-old child, the size of a 2-year-old, in her arms, and the doctor turning on the mother, saying, "Why haven't you fed this child peanut butter, protein?" And the mother saying helplessly, "Where do I find such food?" I must admit, I didn't realize that a 6-year-old child, even though the hospital went into action immediately and put drips and everything into its thin, emaciated arms, died 12 hours later. Even the hospital couldn't save it. Him, I should say. Food distribution continues to be distributed on a political basis. The World Food Programme say that 6 million Zimbabweans are in dire need of food. The government is demanding even that the WFP distribute food through them. A senior WFP official admitted this is now what they're doing, tragically, distributing food to ZANU-PF supporters only. As one WFP spokesman said, at least it means someone gets food. A report from a recent correspondent going in, Stella Mappenthauser, a Reuters correspondent returning to her home in Bulawayo last week, observed that she watched people using wood fires to cook food in the gardens of her suburban neighbors. She said, "I could have been in a rural village and not the second city in what used to be one of Africa's most thriving economies." She said she saw $1,000 notes litter street corners. "If I gave a child 10,000 Zimbabwean dollars, he or she would laugh at me. It costs 100,000 Zimbabwean dollars to buy a piece of candy. I understand the official inflation rate is 27,000% at the moment. The IMF come out with a figure 4 times that." So the title of this debate is meant to be revolution. I'd like to go back to a revolution that could happen. It makes me quite cross when people come up to me after I've been to Zimbabwe and they say, things can't be that bad. Why don't people rise up? Why don't we see a revolution like we saw in Burma or in the Ukraine? Well, surely the answer to that is that people don't have the strength. If every day is a battle for survival, if every day is spent for hours in food queues, how on earth do you get to a demonstration? You have no petrol to get there. And what happens if you get to a demonstration? Ask someone like the brave Jenny Williams of Women of Zimbabwe Arise. For the effort of arising, she and her supporters have spent weeks in jail over the last few months. And even after the government agreed to reform the notorious Public Order and Security Act, which the you probably know bans collections of people demonstrating in Zimbabwe, the act remains as fascist and repressive as ever, says Lovemore Maduku, chairman of the National Constitutional Assembly. December last year, the laws were changed to make it easier to hold political rallies. Only the courts could ban them. But what happened on January the 23rd of this year? After the MDC had been given permission to hold a freedom march, the opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, was taken from his home early in the hours of that day and questioned about his intentions. Hundreds bravely attended, and what happened? Police used tear gas, beat and arrested people. 10 were treated in hospital. So much for reform. So it begs, what has been achieved over the last 10 months of the talks by Mbeki and SADC to try and persuade Mugabe to reform? Very little, alas. So where do we go from here? No future revolution, just slow starvation and depopulation. So what chance do these imminent elections have? Very little, I've been told. People criticize the suddenness of calling the elections and the early nomination date, making it almost impossible to get enough candidates registered in time. The Zimbabwe Election Support Network, the election monitoring group in Zimbabwe, say they have deep concern about these forthcoming elections. 60 new constituencies have been formed which favour urban ZANU-PF strongholds. Already we hear of flawed voters' polls. I'd like to quote again from somebody that I am, voting list. I'd like to quote from somebody that I interviewed in Zimbabwe very recently. I know I've been told I've got about 30 seconds now. But the elections are the next thing on the calendar, as we all know. Someone told me Mugabe has already started rigging these elections. Last week we were registering as voters at a local school. A person who will be standing as a candidate for ZANU-PF next year bought some buses from rural areas full of people to register there. They were coming as far as Mareri, which is something like 200 kilometers from Harare. They were filling the whole room. They were just disturbing the whole process, so we couldn't get to register. And another community worker who told me how he went into a township to encourage people to register was stopped by ZANU-PF militia. They marched us to a disused building, and while we were inside, they started interrogating us. They beat us all over the body with shamrocks, sticks, and under the feet they used bricks to beat us. So this was a situation that happened to us when we were just trying to assist the residents in the suburb to be responsible citizens, so they can use their right to vote and choose an MP of their choice. If you go through what SADC is insisting are the bare minimum for free and fair elections, Zimbabwe is far, far away from achieving these aims. There should be full participation of citizens in the political process. Freedom of association, we saw that fall to pieces on January the 23rd. Political tolerance, constitutional and legal guarantees of freedom and rights of citizens, conducive environment for free, fair elections, and I haven't even got to the press yet. The BBC isn't allowed into Zimbabwe, no great hardship, you'd think, but what about the Daily News and its Sunday sister, the largest circulation newspapers in Zimbabwe before they were banned? Again, Mugabe and the negotiators in Johannesburg agreed that they should be allowed to print in Zimbabwe again, but this isn't happening. Free and fair elections are far away, almost impossible to achieve. Revolution isn't going to happen, and I leave it to others who perhaps would refer to how the original Zimbabwean revolution has been betrayed.
Thank you very much, Sue. Our next speaker is a Zimbabwean who was a lecturer at the University of Zimbabwe until 2003, Knox Chitio, and he now heads the RUSI Africa program. So Knox, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I'll talk on a bit on the revolution, but the more I think of what is of current interest to us, which is the forthcoming election. Just as background, and sorry if I'm telling stuff that people know already, in terms of revolution, we've really had two revolutions in recent times. First was 1979 to 80, when there was a transformation from the minority settler state to a majority ruled state. Then we had the revolution in 2000, the land redistribution revolution. Been very contentious. The methodology by which it was carried out has been very contentious. As we know, the farming sector has had so many problems, but I think it's very difficult to deny that there actually has been an agrarian transformation and an agrarian revolution within Zimbabwe. Those, I think, are the two big revolutions which have occurred. The question now is, where next for Zimbabwe? We are having elections, as we all know, from March the 29th. There have been issues around the elections. No one seriously assumes that we're going to have a free and fair election. I don't think anyone assumes that actually is likely to happen. But the elections are still, I think, of great importance and great relevance to Zimbabwe. And I say this because although we don't have what by Western standards is anything resembling a free and fair election, there's issues around the press, the constituencies, there's so many issues on the elections. It is important, I think, to actually look at the electoral process itself, look at the parties, because what I think we're seeing now is we're seeing a paradigm shift from almost what was almost a one-party state to almost a bipolar opposition state system to seeing what's now becoming almost a multipolar system, because we're having many different parties coming out, many opposition candidates. We've got the different MDCs, the Changirai, the Mutambara group, and within that there are also elements who may within the next few months emerge as well. I suspect we're going to see a splintering within the opposition and the emergence of perhaps yet another party. Within the state itself, within ZANU-PF, we've seen that there's been the emergence of different factions. Last year we saw the emergence of factions within the Juru Mnangagwa group. We've now seen Simbama Kone coming out and declaring himself now that he perhaps would want to stand as well. And I think we're seeing the emergence of perhaps a new generation for Zimbabwe. Unfortunately, it's not going to solve the economic problems anytime soon. What we are looking at here, I think, is a pure party political process. I cannot say that this is going to solve Zimbabwe's economic problems, that it's going to end the crisis within Zimbabwe, but I would say that I think these elections should be taken quite seriously, because at the very least we're going to see the emergence of a new generation. I would also say that as we know, there have been issues between the civil society groups and the opposition groups, with civil society groups saying because the election process is deeply flawed, people should not vote. I would say that I think this is a wrong strategy. I think people should be encouraged to vote, because this is the only chance that people have, whether they're opposition or they support ZANU or whatever. I think people should be encouraged to vote. We know the playing field is not level. There's no doubt about that. But to say because we don't have a level playing field, therefore we shouldn't vote, I think is to play into the hands of the state. So my very strong point is that I think elections should be taken seriously. I think people should be encouraged to vote within Zimbabwe and outside. It's very, very important, because I think there's actually, we're seeing the emergence of a new type of politics within Zimbabwe. How exactly it's going to be constructed, where it will lead, where it's going to be within the next year, no one can say with any authority. But I think we're beginning to see the emergence of a new politics. I mean, it would have been unthinkable almost a year ago to talk of a faction within ZANU-PF that would challenge Robert Mugabe. But we're now seeing this happen. So I think this is very, very important. And in a sense, it's almost revolutionary within itself. It's certainly almost revolutionary within ZANU. ZANU has had internal dissensions before. It's not a new phenomenon. But to emerge, for factions to emerge so openly that they are going to contest against Robert Mugabe, I think is a new paradigm, and it's very, very interesting. So that's my main point, that I think these elections should be taken very, very seriously indeed, because they are a pointer in political terms to the country's future. The actual groups that are jostling within the political groups we know, you've got the MDC, Changirai, you've got the MDC Mutambara. Within both groups, there are various internal groups jostling for power. Within ZANU-PF, there's also been the emergence of a very interesting development. We have a generation of younger people within ZANU-PF who are challenging the established political leadership, the ministers. They're challenging the ministers. There's been issues within ZANU-PF over the choosing of candidates, whether it should be done by electoral means, whether it should be done by other means. This is very, very interesting. And I keep hitting on this thing. We're seeing, or we will be seeing, the emergence of a new generation, both within ZANU, both within the MDC. So I would beg to differ with civic society groups that say, ignore the elections, they're rigged. We know it's going to be a victory for ZANU-PF, so people shouldn't even bother. I think that is a very wrong strategy, because then you're completely throwing away any chance at all of some kind of power accommodation. Because the other thing to bear in mind is that I think there has been a revolution in both the opposition strategy and the ZANU-PF strategy. There's now kind of a convergence occurring. The opposition strategy before had simply been one of more or less, we want Mugabe out. And now, because of the political realities on the ground, I think there's more talk of power sharing, of accommodation. I know the opposition has been criticized for this and saying, well, you know, you can't deal with ZANU on that kind of basis. But I think we're seeing the emergence of something very interesting there. So we're seeing a new dynamic developing, both within the opposition, between the opposition and the state, and also within the state party. And this is a very, very important process. Within ZANU-PF, there are various groups battling for power. There isn't the time yet to go into all the groups. But the emergence also of Simbamakone is interesting. I personally don't think that he's going to win as a presidential candidate. He doesn't have the kind of grassroots support or even the support within the party that will make him a candidate. But I think it's a very interesting development, because it's brought to light in a very open and public way that there is a different perspective within ZANU. Even the opposition, the failure to agree between Mutambara and the Changirai group, I think is also very interesting. At one level, it's a tactical disaster for the opposition that they failed to unite at such a critical moment. In terms of political tactics, I think it's a disaster for them. And it reflects badly in some ways. But at another level, I think it's actually quite a good thing, because it's brought into the open the differences between the two groups, and people now are free to choose. So that's why I said from the beginning we have moved away from this bipolar MDC Changirai versus ZANU. We are now seeing the splintering and the emergence of different groups, and that I think is very, very important. I know time is against me, but I would just like to also mention the regional, just touch on the regional dynamic as well.
Knox, can I ask you to do that? We're not going to have time for discussion if
okay.
we, but there will be an opportunity, I think, to get other points in.
Okay.
I'll
leave it at that.
Thank you very much, Knox. Our third speaker is George Shire, also a Zimbabwean, who is a lecturer at St. Martin's College and has been a commentator on Zimbabwean affairs in a variety of journals in this country. George, the floor is yours. 5 minutes, please.
Thank you. I apologise for not getting here on time. It's just one of those preoccupations trying to get to Whitehall and the traffic and roadworks and so on. So I really sincerely apologise. And I just want to thank you for thinking I had something to offer in this very interesting discussion, timely discussion, in the way in which events in Zimbabwe are unfolding. I kind of come to this debate as somebody whose political DNA, if I can describe it that way, is shaped and formed by a particular set of histories in Zimbabwe, but also resident here. You know, I haven't been on the bus stop. I've just been engaged in politics both there and here. And I think I come into that debate as somebody who sees it as something that's contaminated by the histories that have shaped both Zimbabwe and Britain. And one of the things that I've tried to argue, although it's never very clear when you've got 2 minutes on radio, is I actually think that some of the ways in which the West has engaged in this debate has played indirectly into eroding the support base, different forms of opposition in Zimbabwe politics are. Okay? And it's a very difficult argument to make if you've only got 2 seconds to make, right? You might want to come back to that. And perhaps the implications of that means that it makes it very easy to shut off, to silence, to dismiss forms of opposition in Zimbabwe, if you can put it that way. Because all you have to demonstrate is to say, look, I told you so, they're tied up, they're umbilically connected to the West. And in many ways, in that form of kind of expressing the moral outrage of the West, people have failed to see that people in Zimbabwe have their own ranges of self-interest. And that's an important argument I'm trying to make. The second issue I want to make is that, contrary to the legend, I don't subscribe to the idea that Zimbabwe politics is led from the front. Okay? Of course, there are actors in the drama, if you can put it that way. I don't buy this idea that somehow Zimbabwe people are so ludicrous that, you know, an 83-year-old man could have stitched them up for 7 years without any knowing what's going on. I think we misread that situation deeply and seriously if you look at it that way. What you have to ask yourself the question, what is it that continues to deliver the argument in one room or another? Make that kind of serious observation. And for me, it's to do with two dominant traditions. On one hand is a tradition or traditions that came out of the National Liberation War, that came out of the War of Independence, that indeed President Zimbabwe, they are present in the region. They still have a desire, they still have this desire to reconstitute the state as a distributive instinct, yeah? Whether it might be to do with distributing the land or what they might be doing wrongly or right, but they still have that attachment to it. And there is another which says, you know, okay, forget about all that. Let's just worship at the shrine of entrepreneur, the market, the private, and so on. Okay, and it's very much based within the metropolis. So you've got these two dominant traditions in the place. And because the issues themselves are so deeply conflictual within the makeup of that society, within the makeup of those societies, they were always bound to be a deadly affair. Okay. So in the moment in which you look at it that way, then you have to see the calculations one way or the other. Now, of course, not to just be talking about it, I came in talking about the kind of different personalities that have emerged on the scene in the last 2 or 3 days. I don't, you know, it would be very difficult, I wait to see. I don't see how Simba, for example, could possibly extract himself from the kind of economic narrative that has dominated that place. You know, he's been an architect of the same place altogether. I mean, in some ways, it's very interesting that it emerges in that conversation, because it does show, contrary to the rest of the world, that there is no such thing as an alive and well and kicking political discussion, conflictual as it might be, that has been going on in that country. The other argument I would make is that if you ask the Muslims what are the issues that will determine who they fought for, it certainly is going to be whether or not you reverse the land distribution project to the patterns of 2000 or not, whether you do something about what I call the public good, health, transport, mining, tourism, and so on, whether you do something about your relationships with your neighbors, what do you do with the south-to-south critical regionalism that is emerging, whether or not there is some sort of homegrown notion of how to come out of the economic crisis that is driving the country. The trouble in Zimbabwe is this, that all those forces that are lining themselves out against ZANU-PF have yet to say to certain people like me what it is that they will do differently. And because that argument about what they will do say differently, it ended up being the first thing we'll do when we come into power is to put Robert Mugabe into prison. Well, maybe do. But I don't think getting rid of Robert Mugabe would necessarily determine the economic woes of that country, if that's what it is. So I see very much that what you see in the next year or so is a consolidation rather than a closure, a consolidation of that year in a different direction. I think MDC will have to go back to the drawing board. I think it will have to go to drawing board in order to regroup itself so that it can produce what I would call a national politics. Of course, it speaks to the metropolis, but it fails to translate that metropolitan discourse into a national politics where the majorities of people reside. I think you're likely to see a sort of reconfiguration, what I would call leadership arguments going on in all political parties. And in some ways, if I was Simon, I would have waited until after March. Why? Because I think he's very much, his ascendance in Zimbabwean politics has not been somebody who's a constituent MP. It's been partly to do with being the patronage of the institution of ZANU-PF. In some ways, he's similar to Jonathan Moore in that way. And in many ways, if I was him making a calculation, I really would have waited. Why? Because I think Robert Mugabe is not going to live on this planet forever. But I do think ZANU-PF is going to be there for a long time. And ZANU-PF is an institution. And it has its own structures that will live a long life after I've silenced myself. And in that context, I do think Zimbabwe, a number of others could have played an interesting place in that sense. So let me just finish by relocating the debate here. As long as the British political institutions continue to be seen as being tied to the opposition, you kill the opposition voice in South Africa. And that's a responsibility argument I would make.
Thank you very much, George. I'm sorry, I think I mispronounced your surname, didn't
Shiri.
I? Shiri, yes, sorry, thank you. Right, our final speaker is Michael Ancrum, my colleague in Parliament, who I faced across the dispatch box on a number of occasions when I was at the Foreign Office, spent a lot of time answering questions of which on Zimbabwe that he put to us. Michael, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I'm going to be fairly quick, because I think we want to open it up to the floor. I'd just like to say to Chris that the answers he gave when he was in the Foreign Office, I think, may be slightly different to the answers that he might give today on some of the issues now that he's no longer having to toe the government line. My interest in Zimbabwe is a very simple one. I look at what is happening there, and I am filled with such horror that after 8 years, the international community has not been able to do anything about it. I once described Zimbabwe as the hole in the map of Africa. We worry, quite rightly, about Sudan. We worry, quite rightly, about the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We worry, quite rightly, about Chad. But what has gone on in Zimbabwe has been something on which the international community, by and large, has turned its back. There have been sanctions, which have not worked, as we know. We've seen how easily they have actually been got round. And no international pressure of any merit or strength has been exercised on Zimbabwe. And I believe it is for that reason that we find Zimbabwe in the state it is today. I agree with Knox. I hope that all parties will participate in the elections. I take the view that if you don't participate in elections, you rule yourself out of the game. But I'm under no illusion that these elections are going to be fair or free. If they were, why have the universities been closed until after the elections? If they were going to be fair and free, why was it announced last week that only media favourable to ZANU-PF and Mugabe would be allowed to attend in that country during the elections? Why has the election been called so swiftly?
And all those reasons suggest to me, as they have in the last two elections, that this election is essentially going to be rigged. Very easy, through the voters' register, through the intimidation that can be brought to bear on candidates. We've seen it before, and I think we'll see it again. And maybe it takes an election to show how unfair these are going to be so that the international community might at last be mobilised. I went into Zimbabwe a long time ago now, some 5 years ago, and what I saw there filled me certainly with a determination to carry on my quest for international intervention. I went into the woods outside Harare, where I was taken to meet the black farm workers who'd been evicted from the farms that had been handed over. These were not white farmers. These were black farm workers whose only offence was that their grandparents had come from Malawi. They were starving. They had very little food. They were living under blankets where there weren't tents, and they were effectively being ethnically cleansed. And as I left that day, one of them said to me, "Please don't let the world forget about us." And that's what has fired me up all this time, to make sure that we don't let those people down. Why should there be international intervention? I'll tell you. I saw that day something which to me was as clear a case of ethnic cleansing as anything that you would have found in the Balkans. And in the Balkans, that was a reason for intervention. I saw a refugee problem on my way into Zimbabwe in South Africa. Zimbabweans leaving Zimbabwe because they felt there was no life for them there anymore. If that doesn't internationalize the situation, what does? I saw human rights abuses. I met people who showed me the scars of the beatings they'd received. And we've heard from Sue Lloyd Roberts of the type of beatings that are still taking place. Human rights abuses in other cases have been a reason for international intervention. We've seen electoral manipulation. And I'll tell you what worries me about electoral manipulation, is that in the case of Kenya, there was an immediate international response. Why? Because the manipulation of that election was followed by violence. And the message that can be given to the Zimbabweans is, unless you actually use violence, the international community is not going to react. And my answer to that is, what a message to give. What a thing to say to people who are suffering at the moment. And I want to see the United Nations involving itself in Zimbabwe. I don't know what the outcome of the election is going to be. I heard this morning that in fact Mr. Mutambara is now joined Mr. Materone and is going to back him, so there's a new alignment even within the current one. I want to see these elections used at the end of them as a reason for the international community to say so far and no further. I know there may be people from the South African High Commission here today, and I have listened very carefully to the arguments about quiet diplomacy. But that quiet diplomacy has gone on now since 2000. And quiet diplomacy, which after 8 years has produced no results, is not effective diplomacy. And I plead with the people in South Africa, you too have a benefit in asking the international community to become involved. I'm not looking for British intervention. I know all the post-colonial problems that that would cause. But I'm looking for international intervention of the sort we are seeing in other parts of Africa. If that happens, I think we can bring hope back to the people of Zimbabwe again. I leave you with one statistic which Sue mentioned earlier. The official inflation rate in Zimbabwe is in fact 24,500%. That means that prices are doubling every 4 days, if my calculations are right. That's the official figure. The figure from the IMF last week was 150,000%. We cannot let that country, which was once the breadbasket of Africa, become the basket case of Africa. It is time that the international community started to use its influence and did something about it.